Hello there, everybody, and welcome back to the Weekly POV. I am Josh, and thank you so much for joining me once again. I have a great show for you this week. We're going to talk about the Mandalorian Season 3 premiere episode. We're also going to dive into the news and talk about the box office with Creed 3 debuting this weekend. We're also going to talk about the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles trailer that was released today. And I'm going to review The Last of Us Episode 8. So let's get right into this week's show. So The Mandalorian obviously had its Season 3 premiere episode. And this episode was titled The Apostate. So you're probably wondering, what did I think of this episode? Well, you know, this is the this is my weekly recommendation for this week. I'm definitely recommending The Mandalorian Season 3, Episode 1. Last week, I, of course, recommended rewatching Season 2 and those Book of Boba Fett episodes leading up to this premiere episode because, you know, they're all going to play into this season and what happens. I thought this was a good opening episode. I mean, I'm hearing a lot of complaints online and comparisons to Andor, but for me, The Mandalorian is what I'm here for, and I think it's really important that we keep in mind this is one part of an eight-part season, at least I think it's eight parts, and I think Star Wars fans sometimes forget that this is just one piece of a larger puzzle, and you know, you can't judge a season based off of one episode. So was it my favorite episode of The Mandalorian ever? No, not really even close, but I still enjoyed it for what it was, and I think it kind of sets up where we are and where we're going. You know, there's a few different storylines here in this episode that are happening. We have, you know, first of all, he's an apostate, which means, you know, he's kind of turned from the way because he removed his helmet. So the opening scene features a pretty cool action scene with like this giant space Star Wars crocodile alligator type of creature. And it kind of reminded me of the Krayt dragon from Season 2. So is there a little bit of a repeat here with a huge beast that Mando eventually has to take down? Yeah. But it's still a pretty fun opening episode and introduces us to the Mandalorians again, and Din Djarin, of course, coming to the rescue and trying to find a way for him to be restored in the Mandalorian way. And basically, you know, he's told that the only way for him to do this is to go to Mandalore, and basically he has to be submerged maybe in the water underneath Mandalore, and maybe it's some type of baptism type thing. I'm not sure, but so, you know, we see that part of the storyline, and then he also goes to Navarro. So we see that whole thing, and he's reunited with Greef Karga, and I was curious, Adam and I were both curious about what happened to Cara Dune. How are they going to explain this? And apparently, because of what happened in Season 2, she's been called up to Special Forces, and that's how they're kind of, you know, explaining her not being there. But I was satisfied with this explanation, even though I'm going to miss the character. At least they mentioned her and addressed that. So I was appreciative of that. There's some things that happen on Navarro here that, you know, maybe felt either a little out of place or unnecessary with, you know, the conflict with the pirates and everything like that. So it wasn't my favorite part of the episode, but it was nice to see, you know, Carl Weathers back as Greef Karga again and being a part of the story. And he even offers Mando and Grogu a place to stay, but of course Mando has another mission, and his mission is, you know, again to be reinstated into his, you know, Mandalorian way and everything like that. And so he ends up in the last part of the episode, he goes and visits Bo-Katan and is looking for her help to be able to go to Mandalore and succeed in this mission and everything. And she basically turns him down. She's pretty much given up all hope. And that's pretty much where the episode ends. So, you know, there's a few different locations we go to, and it kind of sets up maybe some of the characters that we'll be seeing in this season. This episode only clocked in around, you know, I guess including the intros and outros and everything, it's like 37, 38 minutes, but It amounted to pretty much like a half an hour episode. So again, this is one complaint I have with The Mandalorian, that the runtime could be a little bit longer, but at least they're not adding things just to inflate the runtime, and they're just telling the story they need to tell and the amount of time that they want to tell it, which is fine. But, you know, it's one of those things where I just kind of wish it was a little bit longer, I guess. But I did enjoy this episode. It wasn't, you know, the greatest, but, you know, I'm still curious to see where we go from here. So that is my recommendation for this week. But now let's head into the news segment on this week's show. Okay, so speaking of The Mandalorian, we're going to talk about a little bit of news about The Mandalorian, and I guess it's, you know, it's not really, I don't know if you consider it news or not, but we're going to talk about it anyway. The space whales that Grogu saw in season 3's premiere episode. So we can kind of see Grogu looking out and he sees the space whales, and I was like, oh, I swear I've seen them before, and then I kind of remembered Rebels, and I loved Rebels. It was a great show, but it's been a minute since I've seen it. And you know, these space whales are going definitely to tie into the Ahsoka series, and I wonder if we'll see them again in this season of The Mandalorian. But they're known as Purgil, and they live in deep space, and they're naturally able to fly through hyperspace. But they often collide with other ships that are traveling through hyperspace and everything like that. So if you don't remember, at the end of Star Wars Rebels, basically Ezra kind of summoned the Purgil and to take the Chimera, which was Grand Admiral Thrawn's flagship, into hyperspace and away from Lothal, where it took him and Ezra, you know, it took Thrawn and Ezra maybe into the unknown regions. Which, you know, is where this story is going, especially with Ahsoka, because at the end of Rebels, we see Ahsoka and Sabine ready to go on a mission to find Ezra. And of course, in season 2 of The Mandalorian, the Jedi episode, she asks at the end, where is Grand Admiral Thrawn, to the magistrate of that town in that episode. So I'm really excited to see where this goes. Are we going to see Ezra in The Mandalorian? I don't know. Maybe they'll wait till Ahsoka, but I like where this is all going with Thrawn potentially being a villain in this Dave Filoni universe or in Jon Favreau universe. And I got to say, I might be asking myself, and I don't know if anybody else is asking this, but I am, do we need in Star Wars, do we need the next George Lucas? You know, George Lucas was an amazing visionary and creator of the whole Star Wars franchise. And it was always, he was also always basically at the helm, you know, for the original trilogy, for the sequel trilogy. He brought in other directors for the, you know, the originals and the prequel trilogy, excuse me. But he brought in other directors for the original trilogy and everything, but he was always, you know, at the helm. And now we've got like so many people playing in this Star Wars sandbox. And while I appreciate a show like Andor for its many layers and production quality and acting, and it was really well done, but it didn't really feel like Star Wars to me necessarily at times and for the most part. So my question is, do we need the next George Lucas? And I think we already have that. And I think that's Dave Filoni. In my personal opinion, I think he should, you know, he was the Padawan learner of George Lucas. George Lucas was the master. He was the Padawan. And now Dave Filoni is the master. I think the things that Dave Filoni are involved with are the strongest things we've gotten in Star Wars, maybe except for like Rogue One. Or The Force Awakens, but you know, his involvement in Tales of the Jedi animated series, of course, his work with The Clone Wars season 7, his work with The Mandalorian, the episodes that he directed. I mean, he knows Star Wars. He knows he knows George Lucas's vision. And I think he has a very similar vision. So I would love eventually at some point to see Dave Filoni being that person, that everything kind of goes through him. But I don't know. What do you guys think? Do you think Star Wars should continue to be this sandbox that everybody gets to play in? Or should there be one lead visionary, and should that person be Dave Filoni? Let me know what your thoughts are in the comments section. Okay, but moving on, let's head into the box office for this weekend. And Creed 3 opened and knocked out the competition, according to comingsoon.net. So let's take a look at those box office results. It opened with what comingsoon.net is calling a sensational $58.6 million domestically, which was the best opening for a sports movie ever, which is kind of crazy, and also a franchise record, obviously, for the Rocky, you know, franchise or Creed franchise. So that's pretty impressive. Creed 2 ended up earning $214 million worldwide, and the original Creed took in $173 million globally. So we'll see if Creed 3, you know, should be able to do that. I'm wondering, like, what is the draw here with Creed 3, you know, because we lost Sylvester Stallone. I thought maybe that would, you know, push away some viewers, but it seems like that wasn't the case. And this thing just, man, people want to see it. I don't know. Is it Jonathan Majors? Is it Michael B. Jordan? Is it, you know, is it just how good the first and second Creed were? I'm not sure, but let me know what you guys think. Are you interested in seeing Creed 3? Have you seen it? What are your thoughts? So that is the box office. Ant-Man dropped another 62% to bring its domestic total to $186.3 million worldwide. It has collected almost $420 million, but it has a ways to go to beat the original Ant-Man at $519 million and Ant-Man and the Wasp at $622 million. So this has been kind of tough for Ant-Man and the Wasp, and I don't know exactly how to explain it other than, you know, it getting bad word of mouth and bad reviews, and maybe people just didn't enjoy it as much as I did. So, you know, I don't know how Ant-Man and the Wasp or Ant-Man Quantumania is going to end up doing with Creed 3 performing this well, but we shall see. Moving over to DC, we have some set photos that unveil a first look at Colin Farrell's return to the Penguin. So for the Penguin HBO Max series, we have some set photos where he's wearing the purple jacket here. So you can just get a first look here at Colin Farrell as the Penguin. And so I'm definitely looking forward to this series, and I'm a big fan of the Penguin character. I'm a big fan of the Batman and Matt Reeves version of this. So I'm interested in exploring more things from this version, this iteration of Batman. Let's move on to David Harbour and Stranger Things 5. We may have got a filming start date from David Harbour. So let's take a look at that. So he recently sat down with Collider and confirmed that production on the fifth and final season of Stranger Things is going to be starting this June. So he said, "We're walking into season 5. I've got a couple more months to train. We start shooting that in June, though, and that will be the final season." He says, "I did a lot of training for season 4. He said he was in a very specific position, the Russian prison, but now he's back in town. He's back in America where they have cheeseburgers," he said, "so he will be well fed." Now, just based off of this information and starting to film in June, I'm wondering what that means for when the release date will be of season 5 of Stranger Things. And while I want them to take their time with this and do an excellent job, I also really want to see season 5. I'm sure many of you out there do as well. But, you know, can they pull this off in a year? Could we see season 5 coming out in June of in the summer of 2024, or will it be fall of I'd like to see it sometime in 2024. I'm not sure how long all of this will take to complete, but I guess we'll have to wait and see with a release date. But I sure am excited for whenever it comes out. And we got a new trailer today for Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles Mutant Mayhem, which is being produced by Seth Rogen. And it's animated, and you know, I have some thoughts about this teaser trailer, and I'll play a little bit of that for you guys who are watching on YouTube here. And it reminded me of Into the Spider-Verse, with Miles Morales, that type of animation. It's kind of familiar to that. I mean, I would prefer a live action Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles because I, you know, my favorite is the original and Secrets of the Ooze and everything. If they're gonna go animated, I guess the look of this is fine, but I didn't love it. I mean, I felt like Donatello's kind of sounded like a small child, and I'm not sure why. I mean, he should be a teenager, but that kind of bothered me a little bit. And I'm just not completely sold on this yet, but I'll definitely get a chance. I'm a huge Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles fan. I was a fan ever since I was a kid, and I saw those original movies. I collected all the action figures and everything. That's what I watched growing up. So I'll give it a chance. And I do like the fact that Splinter is being vo voiced by Jackie Chan, and there's some other familiar voices being lended here, including Seth Rogen and John Cena, Giancarlo Esposito. So we'll have to see how the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles Mutant Mayhem turns out. And that is coming in August of this year. And so. Yeah, I'll definitely give it a look and give it a chance. But what do you guys think? Are you excited about this version of the Ninja Turtles or not? Let me know in the comments section. But yeah, there's the cast list right there. And again, this one comes out in August of 2023. So that pretty much wraps it up for the news this week. And at this point in time, I'm going to head into the Last of Us Episode 8 review. Okay, so this week's episode of The Last of Us is called When We Are in Need. And this was a really good episode. We got introduced to some new characters. You know, the interesting thing about this series is it's just Joel and Ellie navigating through this world and navigating through different locations and meeting different characters. And a lot of those characters happen to die, in this very violent show, but they also, you know, show the violence in a way that you feel it. You know, it's not just like something that hopefully you're desensitized to. It can be really uncomfortable, and I think that's intentional. And I know that's intentional because I've listened to the podcast and everything on my way drive home today, and just the inside the episodes, and they want you to feel that violence because of how, you know, in real life it's not something to be messing around with, and it's something to be taken seriously, and there's a cost and a consequence to violence. But the main new character we get introduced to in this episode is David. And the episode opens with David, who is a preacher of this kind of small group they have going in Colorado, and he's reading from Revelation 21. And of course, being a Christian, this was definitely interesting that it opened up with scripture and everything like that, and particularly this scripture about, you know, the new heaven and the new earth and everything, and God will wipe away all tears from their eyes. You know, David's trying to comfort this girl, a new world. Basically, the idea that this new world that can be better than the last world was, and it's kind of about maintaining, for this episode, I think it's about maintaining faith in the face of loss, because this girl lost her father, and that really ties into Joel and Ellie later in the episode. So it's just when you think that maybe there's something that's not that important, it becomes important later in the episode. So basically, David is one of the characters, and then we have Troy Baker, who played Joel in the video game, and he plays James, which is he's kind of like, maybe I would say David's kind of right-hand man kind of person. And basically they live in the Silver Lake Resort, which, as it turns out, is a rough place to live in the winter. They're getting low on resources and low on food, and they're very hungry. And this all plays a role into things that unravel later in this episode. And I liked how reminiscent the restaurant was. You know, the restaurant kind of serves as kind of a you know, a community type room that they have and they gather in. And it reminded me of the video game, of course. And one of the most frustrating moments in the video game was playing through the scenario that happens at the end of this episode with David and Ellie. But basically, in this episode, we see Ellie trying to nurse Joel back to health. And Joel is not doing well. We can tell that his wound is infected. The creators of the show said that Ellie was asking herself the question, what would Joel do? And he would go out and hunt for food. Now that they've pretty much run out and they were eating the last bits of the beef jerky that they had. So Ellie does take it upon herself to go out and hunt. And this is really Ellie's episode. And the interesting thing is this part of the game you play as Ellie. And this is really, you know, Ellie's in control basically. And that's what her role is in this episode. She's trying to protect Joel instead of him protecting her. And she kind of has to stand on her own here. And, you know, she does go out and she ends up shooting a deer, and it seems like she's applying what Joel has taught her. She takes a deep breath before pulling that trigger and everything. But then she also happens to run into David and James, who also they get to the deer before she does, because after she hits the deer, it kind of runs off. And she tries to basically make a deal with them because she's in need of medicine for Joel. She knows Joel's not going to make it unless he gets some kind of, you know, antibiotic or penicillin, something like that. So she makes a deal, half of the deer if they give her medicine, so they can have half of the deer, basically. So David has James go to get the medicine because Ellie's like, she's being tough about it. You know, she's like, no, I'm not going anywhere with you guys. I'm not going, you know, I'm going to send him to go get the medicine. I'm going to stay right here with the deer. But then David and Ellie end up getting into this conversation. And I think David is really attracted to Ellie's power. And, you know, Craig Mason, who's one of the showrunners, mentioned that David kind of has this attraction to her and wants to own her, basically wants to possess her. In a way. And so David, in the beginning of this episode, he's really presented as a good guy. You know, we see him as this preacher and he's trying to help Ellie. He shows her mercy. He's willing to give her medicine. But then as the episode goes along, we see kind of a darker side of David's character. And I think he's really even compared to like a cult leader. And we see with a lot of cult leaders, you know, that they are basically narcissists, you know, and it comes back to the attention being on them and not really on the Bible or the Word of God or anything like that. And we see shades of that with David too, in that cult leadership role. And David reveals that he actually didn't become a preacher and he wasn't a believer until after the outbreak. He did mention the Pittsburgh QZ. I think he was probably from Pittsburgh area, which was a nice nod since we didn't get to go there in the show. And I was very sad about that because I love Pittsburgh and I'm from near Pittsburgh. But, you know, the show didn't go there, but at least they mentioned the Pittsburgh QZ here. So while this conversation is going on, David reveals to Ellie, you know, and he really gets her into the story and everything, reveals that Joel actually killed one of the men from their group at the university that they went to. And the one that basically stabbed him with that shard of the baseball bat, Joel killed him. He was the father of the girl we see in the beginning of the episode. So again, it ties back to that, that being her father who was killed. And so now Ellie's like kind of freaking out and James shows up and has the gun on her. But they end up still giving her the medicine, because again, David wants her to join him. That is basically his goal here. So he still gives her the medicine, even revealing this information. And then we kind of go back to Joel, you know, who's down in the basement again, not doing well, but she has given him some of the antibiotic and everything like that. So we see a little bit of time pass, and then David and his people end up coming back. I'm assuming it was maybe like the next day or something like that. And Ellie gives Joel the knife, and I love this part. And she kind of tells him, kill anyone who comes down here. But she's going to try to lead them away from him. So again, Ellie is protecting Joel in when you would think it would be the other way around. And I just love that moment where she's kind of telling him what to do and telling him how to survive. And it's very opposite of what has been happening through the course of this show. So we get some pretty brutal action with Joel. Again, for me, that was reminiscent of the video game where he knifes one of David's men from behind. And you know, he's like operating at like 10%, but Neil Druckmann, another one of the show's creators, said Joel fighting at 10% is better than these other guys 100%, basically. And he's fighting here for Ellie. You know, he's not just fighting for his own life, but he's fighting for Ellie. And so that just raises the bar. And so he ends up killing one of those men, and then another two of them he ends up capturing. He tortures one of them for information on Ellie's location, and then ends up killing them both. And again, a very brutal scene. You know, again, it was kind of hard to watch with the violence and everything. But at the same time, you're kind of rooting for it in a sick and twisted kind of way. But you know, we get back to the resort, and we see Ellie is kind of in this cage, and they're keeping her in this cage because David said, you're a dangerous person. I can't just let you loose. You need to be in this cage. He's basically saying, I want you to join me. You know, I want you to be an equal with me, or, you know, something to that effect. But then we start to see more of his violent nature. He admits to having a violent nature, and that's how he connects with Ellie, because he sees her violent nature. And he even says the cordyceps is fruitful and multiplies. Another thing he said about cordyceps is that it secures its future with violence if it must. So it spreads, it's fruitful, it multiplies, it secures with violence if it must. And I think that's what he's saying about himself. Like, if I have to resort to violence to maintain what I've built here, I'm going to do that. And we see that evident even when he like smacks the young girl in the restaurant, because she, I don't even know what she did. I don't remember. Maybe she talked back or just kind of was just questioning things that were happening there. And has that power over her by, you know, hitting her and everything. But again, he's trying to convince Ellie to join him and basically be his wife, it seems. And Ellie takes his hand and pretends like, you know, she's going to, but then she breaks his hand, and just again, her violence comes out. And then David comes back in with James and everything, and they're about to cut her up, because what Ellie sees in this room where she's caged, she sees a human ear. And kind of works it out for herself that they're basically eating each other now. They're starving to the point of eating each other, or eating their dead. And they're about to cut her up too, but she tells them that she's infected as a distraction, and ends up killing James with a cleaver. And then she sets fire to the restaurant, and it's just her and David one-on-one. And this is that part of the video game that was very frustrating for me and very hard to get past. And hopefully I'll do better this next time around as when I play it again. But basically David ends up overpowering her and is on top of her. And it seems like something really bad's about to happen. Like I got the impression that he was about to rape her. But she, you know, ends up killing him and hits him multiple times with the cleaver, just like very violent, very grotesque. again, her violence coming out. And then eventually, you know, you think the whole time, because Joel makes his way there, you think he's going to come in and save her. But, you know, again, going back to the creators, they're feeling that Ellie needed to save herself in this situation. So, basically Joel and Ellie end up finding each other, and Joel, you know, kind of consoles her. He even calls her baby girl. So we know we're at the point where, man, they just love and care so much for each other. There is that father-daughter relationship that's solidified now. And that's really going to, you know, play a big part in the finale. And this whole episode basically is Ellie surviving on her own and taking care of Joel. And again, in this part of the game, you play as Ellie, which was pretty cool. And Neil Druckmann also said that this moment that Ellie had with David in the restaurant is basically, it scars her in a way that will change her forever. And how Joel feels about her now, again, is all leading to a very big choice that Joel is going to have to make in the finale. And I won't spoil what that choice is going to be. I'll let you guys find out. But I'm looking forward to seeing the finale and seeing if it deviates from the game, or if the same decision is made by Joel, because it has huge ramifications for the series going forward, as it did in the game and leading into The Last of Us Part 2. So what did you guys think of Episode 8, When We Are in Need? Let me know in the comment section below. Well, thank you once again, everybody, for joining me this week. I really hope you enjoyed this week's show. And as always, you can find me on our YouTube channel, From a Certain Point of View, on Twitter at CertainPOVPod. And you can send me an email on our Gmail account. That's CertainPOVPod@gmail.com. We're also a proud member of the Red 5 Network. You can find on their website, red5network.com, or at Red 5 Network on Twitter. Be sure to check them out. And thank you so much, as always. May the Force be with you, and everything I said today was true, from a certain point of view.